provocatively. I hope some of your listeners will try to challenge me in this. There is zero research in the world that supports letter grade. None.
Well, hey again, everyone, and welcome to the Modern Learners Podcast. I'm Will Richardson, your host. First of all, Happy New Year. You may not be listening to this right after the New Year, but that's when we're recording this. It is great that you're starting 2018 with us, and we are looking forward to a learning-filled year and a momentum-building year for schools that are trying to change and reimagine what happens in classrooms. And if you are on that boat of reimagination, this podcast is one that will really get your head thinking. Bruce and I had the opportunity to interview Scott Looney, who is the head of the Hawkins School and also the founder of the Mastery Transcript Consortium at mastery.org. We talked to him right before Christmas, and it was a fascinating conversation about his attempt to get schools together to create a totally different way of assessing what kids do in school and to put together a transcript that has no numbers, but is all about competency-based achievements. It's a provocative conversation, and I'm not going to give more of it away. You heard that first little snip before the music. That should be all you need in terms of a tease to listen to the rest of it. Don't forget, if you are listening to this in early January, we have a couple weeks left before enrollment for Change School 4 closes. Right now, we are well more than halfway to our goal. So if you do catch this podcast sooner rather than later, please head over to change.school and check us out. And like I said, we are just really excited for 2018, and we hope you join us for our future podcast. You are on the lookout for white papers that are coming down the pike, webinars and workshops that we're doing, Change Leaders Community, Change School, lots going on here at Modern Learners, and we look forward to working with you at some point during 2018. But for now, just sit back and enjoy this great conversation with Scott Looney. Thanks again for listening. So welcome, everyone. So if you're listening later on the podcast, this is a really special episode for us because we get a chance to talk today to someone who has been informing our work a great deal and who I think is pretty inspiring. And for those of you who are watching live right now on Facebook, you can see our guest, Scott Looney, who is in our third little window there on Zoom. And just a quick introduction about Scott. It's really our pleasure to welcome him today. He is the headmaster of the Hawkins School outside of Cleveland, Ohio, where I think it's 11 years, Scott, is that right, that you've been there?
12, yeah.
Yep. 12 years. And in that time has done some really interesting work in terms of changing the systems and kind of cultures of what learning looks like and the structures of what learning looks like in that school, has become a pretty outspoken independent school leader for change at a high level. And most recently, however, has done something that I find just to be fascinating and that I use everywhere that I go to push people's thinking. And that is, he is the founder of the Mastery Transcript Consortium, which you can find at mastery.org. And he is engaged with building a network of schools, independent schools, and I think some public schools. We'll talk about that in a second. But they're taking on the really easy task of trying to get rid of grades in high school, which should have been done probably, decades ago. But you talk about, biting off a big, taking a big bite into the whole change conversation around schools. I mean, that's a huge one. And I think we'd love to start there, Scott. I'd just love to hear a little bit of background as to what the genesis was of that work and kind of the conversations that led up to it. And, where you're at with that right now, because I know you're about a year into it, but I'm also hearing that you're, you've got a long path ahead of you. So just tell us a little bit about what Mastery is about and what brought you to that work.
Sure. I'd be thrilled to have the opportunity. And Will and Bruce, thank you for having me on this podcast. And I appreciate the opportunity. We didn't start out to create a consortium of schools across the world to change grades. We actually just wanted a non-graded transcript for Hawkins School. And I have permission from our board of trustees and enthusiasm from our faculty to create school within a school, a second high school embedded within our existing high school. And our existing high school is a progressive school, but I would say it's closer to progressively flavored than the ideal that I'd like. And so the faculty here and I are excited about the idea of building a strand within our high school that's a completely based on educational research and ignoring literally every existing convention, saying if we had a blank slate and we could create a high school track for kids in Cleveland, Ohio, what would it look like? And it's very much like you would expect it to be. It's all project and problem based. It's interdisciplinary. It's intergrade level. There are no grade levels. There are no no ninth graders take classes with 12th graders, no grades. It's all real world applied. We find real problems in the world that whoever owns the problem is willing to let high school kids work on. And the teacher assumes the role of master to the student's apprentice. And as we started to build this, and we built some prototypes, we built an entrepreneurship course, we built an engineering course, and these are 3-credit interdisciplinary courses based on real world problem solving. As we got deeper into that, we realized that some of the things that were getting in our way were grades, were Carnegie units, and frankly, content course labels. When entrepreneurship, for example, is 60% of a kid's schedule when they take it, so it shows up in a traditional transcript as just one little class that has no description. So we started deciding, well, we needed a non-graded different transcript. So we hired Hanover Research to go out and do a survey of the industry, assuming that there's 37,000 high schools in the United States. There has to be some good models out there. And most people, unless they're a direct competitor, are pretty generous. And we'd borrow it, modify it, thank our host for letting us use their intellectual property, and we'd move be on our way. And Hanover came back and said, yeah, what you want doesn't seem to exist. We can't find it. And we didn't believe him. I made him do it again. I said, no, you know, you must have missed something. There has to be. And so they did it again. And they came back and said, well, there are some non-graded high schools, less than 2%, probably less than 1% are non-graded. He said, but even at the non-graded high schools, mostly they list content labeled courses with Carnegie units. He said, we cannot find a high school that has a transcript that doesn't have at least one of the three. And almost all of the ones that we could find that don't have all three have two of the three. And we actually don't believe.
Really briefly, yeah. I know Poughkeepsie Day was one school that I was familiar with that didn't give grades. But at the end of the day, they had to turn that into something that higher education could make sense of. Right?
Yeah, so. and Watershed doesn't, but they started finding out that the colleges were having such a difficult time processing this that they actually added a GPA. They just made one up. They gave to kids. And there was more science to it than that. I'm telling them short. But they kind of broke my heart to hear that. They actually had a beautiful assessment model. But because it was so hard for the colleges to figure it out, and the colleges were basically just assigned a GPA based on their estimates, they said, no, let us assign it because at least we'll get it right. So when we realized that it didn't exist in the world, we thought we were the little engine that could. So fine, we'll just create our own non-graded transcript. And we did. We started creating transcript prototypes, and we started having a few that we kind of really liked. My background prior to being ahead, I did a lot of enrollment management. So I have more than a few friends who've left prep school admission and are now doing college admission. So I started running these prototypes by my friends in college admissions. And I would say to them, hey, what do you think about a transcript like this? What would you think if Hawkins started presenting kids like this? And they all have pretty much the same reaction. They looked at it and said, wow, this is really interesting. This would produce really interesting kids. Yeah, we're going to hate it.
Right.
And I said, well, okay, do tell. And they said, well, Scott, if Hawkins has a unique transcript, if we're sitting there reading thousands of applications, all of a sudden, you know, you have something that looks completely different. I have new admission readers every year and they're in their 20s. I don't have time to stop the process, sit down and train them how to do this. Frankly, we're just going to ignore it and look at your kid's SAT score. And so we pretty much gave up for a little while until I ran into one of these deans, and it was a dean at a very selective college. I said, just out of curiosity, what if I brought like 25 or 50 other prep schools with me? And it was really interesting. She immediately said, oh, well, that would be completely different then. If there's schools like yours and schools with your kind of academic standards, and we knew we were going to see hundreds of these, then we'd have to learn how to read them. And we assume if they came from schools like yours, they'd be pretty credible. So that was the point that the Mastery Transcript Consortium was born. I cold called 30 of my friends who lead schools. Hey, can I get you to come to Cleveland for 2 days to have a conversation about this? And I thought maybe if 15 of the schools at the end of 2 days decided that they join this effort, we might have something. And 28 of the 30 signed up immediately. And that was it. And I knew we were onto something. And now we're at a little over a year and a half later, we're at about 160 schools from 15 different countries.
That's crazy. That's great. Yeah. I mean, and the one quote on the website, too, that I love is, you know, you guys say the high school transcript aims to assess student progress and performance, but it is a broken instrument that no longer serves students, teachers, or the world outside our school walls. And my sense of it is that most educators in their heart of hearts knows that that's an accurate statement, that that's truth, but they don't really know what to do about it. And they don't really have they don't have the courage or the commitment maybe to go out and change it in the ways that you're talking. So, you know, what is the sense in terms of how do you unbreak the transcript? I mean, how do you make it something then that not only colleges can use to assess the kids that you're, you know, that you're sending them, but also is just a better experience for kids and is the right thing to do for kids? What does that look like then?
Sure. Sure. You know, you just said, you know, they didn't have the courage. I actually don't think it's about courage. It's about it's foolhardy to think that any individual person or any individual school can take on a ubiquitous 130-year-old paradigm and win. Mm-hmm. So it's not stupid for a school to say, yeah, I know this is broken, but what am I to do? You know, especially schools where, you know, whether you're public or private, if the vast majority of your kids have college aspirations, you know, it's really dangerous to think about going your own way and wondering whether you're actually enfeebling your kids' chances to get college. So, but what gives people courage is numbers. And I always believe that if some of the finest prep schools in the world would aggregate, we're really hard to say no to, because we have, in some cases, a 100, 200-year reputation of having very high standards. So it would be very hard for a college admission office to say, oh, you have Andover, Exeter, Lakeside, Punahou. How do we know this is rigorous? Like, well, it's Andover, Exeter, Lakeside, and Punahou. That's how you know it's rigorous. So that was part of the strategy. But what I would say is that there are three main elements to a transcript, and they're all terrible ideas. First is that we should represent the knowledge, skills, and development of kids based on the content they sat proximate to. That's not a great idea. And that we should give credit simply for how long you were exposed to something. Carnegie Unit's a unit of time. It's not anything more than that. So a kid with a C minus gets the same credit as a kid with an A. And then the last one, which is, and I say this very provocatively, I hope some of your listeners will try to challenge me in this. There is zero research in the world that supports letter grading. None. It has never existed. It didn't exist when grades were launched over 100 years ago. The very first study of grading was done in 1908. It was published in Science. And the conclusion was, this is a horrible idea and a horrible failure, which we must stop doing immediately. That's not what happened. It took over the world. And it became the primary way we assess achievement. It's never been legitimate. And even if it had been legitimate, if you go back to Mount Holyoke, which was really the first university that used them broad scale, it was designed to be a bell curve where as many kids who got B's got D's and as many kids who got A's got F's. That's no longer true. So other than a terrible idea that's been corrupted, it's fine.
So I'm interested that you raised the aspect of bringing in, you know, schools around the world, top schools across a number of countries in helping make this happen, Scott. And my obvious reaction to that, first reaction to that is, well, look at International Baccalaureate. Mm-hmm. IB was one direction that those schools took. And I'm interested how you've positioned yourself either against that or with that.
Yeah, I would say we haven't done either. And in fact, the intent was not to start an intellectual coalition. In fact, we've done exactly zero outreach to international schools. I just was trying to aggregate as quickly as I could some of the better perceived American prep schools. They found us. We've done zero outreach. And we did that kind of for a reason. We're very new. We have a grand total of 2 full-time employees with 3 part-time employees supporting this effort. Now, we've raised $4 million of capital, and we have an annual operating budget a little over $1 million, but we're not ready to take on the world yet. It's a little premature, and we're certainly not ready to have a sit down with the powers that be at the IB and talk about either partnership or competition. The IB seems to me like a real possibility for partnership, to be honest. There's some philosophical underpinnings of the IB that seem pretty consistent with where we want to go, but I have to remind everybody, especially any of your listeners, that we're just getting started and we have a reasonably long time horizon. We're telling schools and colleges that we're 6 to 8 years away from producing mastery transcripts. So this is not a sprint. This is more of a marathon. And we're trying to very thoughtfully and incrementally grow our coalition and then begin our work. So fortunately, a group of schools from all over the world started to find us, and they were very credible members. So we added them to our, we thought we'd open the onion, you know, one layer at a time. And unfortunately, it just kind of popped right open.
And has there been interest across the public sector? Because that's obviously a completely different conversation, but a very important one. What's been the response in that area?
Well, the first thing that's important to note is that the public sector is, on average, way ahead of the independent schools on competency and proficiency-based assessment. We are not actually leading in that area. What we are trying to do, though, is give everybody who wants to go in this direction around assessing kids for mastery, about having kids persist to mastery and competency, not move along when the teacher moves the whole class forward. That movement's way bigger than us. And really, the leaders in the states are the New England states, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island. And David Roof, who runs an organization called the Great Schools Partnership, which serves over 200 public districts. Mm-hmm. When we were getting ready to start this, we went to David first and we said, David, should we do this as a public-private partnership from the get-go? And we talked it through and he basically encouraged us to think about, no, you guys go first. In the independent schools, mm-hmm. you guys have one real structural advantage that we don't have, which is that you're independent. You don't have to sort of work through sort of the local legislative angles around things. You can maybe get to a proof of concept first. But David agreed to join our advisory council. We have a number of well-placed people in the public school world who are advising us. And in our pilot phase, where we're going to be hand selecting a handful of schools to pilot our platform that we're building, many of those schools will be public schools. And we've started to line those up as well. What we don't want to do, though, is overpromise and underdeliver. And the complexity across different, not just even states, even different districts within states, it's a level of complexity that we're not quite ready to take on yet because of our immature age. But we have about 80 school districts that have raised their hand and contacted us and say, hey, we like what you're doing. We'd really like to be part of it. And we said, hey, we'd love to have you. But you know what? Let us get our feet under us first to make sure that we can serve your needs before we start making any promises. And so we anticipate opening it up to public school members sometime in the next 6 to 12 months would be my guess. But we also trying to make sure everybody knows what we're biting off before we
start. I think, I mean, to me, your approach and the strategy you're taking, you know, makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, this is a big task. There's not much bigger, really. I was in the back of my mind, and I think we may have mentioned this before we started, the little old nation state across the pond from us, New Zealand, would seem to be very well placed. I would be surprised if they didn't show a lot of interest in this area because both where they're at and where they're heading.
Yeah, and one of the things we're doing right now is we're broadening our initial board of trustees and our advisory council to include people from the public sphere, from higher ed, from kind of the high level assessment organizations to make sure that we have a kind of a proper representation. I think as we think about trying to partner with different countries, you know, New Zealand, as we were talking before we got online, is right at the top of the list of possible partners for what we're doing. They're well ahead of really, as far as I've seen, any other country in terms of thinking about mastery-based assessment.
Yeah. So, Scott, on your website at mastery.org, you have a dropdown for a new model. And when you look at that, you have a mock-up of a transcript. It says the Hawkins School. My first question is, so did you guys create that? Because you started it as an exercise for just your school. Were you able to get to the point where you've begun to use that or?
No, we were just that all the models we have right now are simply theoretical constructs. The tricky part about trying to describe what we're doing to anyone is without some kind of concrete visuals, we found it really difficult to get people to understand what we're trying to do. On the other hand, the minute you put a concrete example out there, people assume that's exactly what you're going to do, which isn't quite right. We've hired a firm out of Seattle called Intentional Futures. They're a design ideation firm. And so right now they're doing two things for us. They're helping design the kind of prototyping process that we're going to go through. And they have a pretty robust data visualization team. And so I suspect we'll have, 15 to 20 different data visualizations that we will play with. And then we're going to go out to all of the people involved in this, the schools, the teachers, students, college admission readers, and eventually settle in on one data visualization. One of the things that's really important, even though the content on a mastery transcript is specific to the sending school, the format has to be consistent across all mastery transcript schools. Because we've promised college admission readers that the one-page summary, the homepage, even though it's an electronic transcript that has a lot of depth to it, the one page has to be readable in 2 minutes. You know, the high-volume admission shops are not going to be excited to get a transcript that takes 7 or 8 minutes to read. So in order to hit that, we're going to have to insist that if it's called a mastery transcript, it follows at least a visual format that's consistent across schools.
So on that mock-up that's on your site, you have things like analytical and creative thinking, complex communication, global perspective, integrity and ethical decision-making, habits of mind. And I think it's interesting you list as one of the featured credits there, persistence as, I guess, a credit that a student gets for exhibiting that particular habit of mind. So I'm curious, where does content knowledge play into that, right? Because most of what you see on that screen, most of what you see on that page really is about those dispositions and those literacies, but not so, and the skills, but not so much about the content knowledge, which is now pretty much what we're assessing in schools. So what happens to that?
Well, here's a little bit of a radical idea. The Mastery Transcript Consortium is in fact completely agnostic on that question, because it's up to the school to answer that question. So Hawken may decide that our Mastery Transcript deeply overprivileges skills and habits of mind and underprivileges content knowledge. And that's probably where we're going to end up, because we actually have something written into our mission that says we privilege the development of essential skills over the acquisition of content knowledge. We actually wrote it into our mission. Mm-hmm. But another school, maybe a pretty traditional school, might just say, no, knowledge is science. And we're going to represent science as a series of credits capturing content knowledge. And we're not going to dictate to our members the degree to which they privilege. What we are trying to do is open up space on the transcript for credits beyond, in addition to, content, mastery of content knowledge. So you can get a credit for public speaking. You can get a credit for agility in ambiguity. You can get a credit in sublimating your ego for the greater good, right? You can get a credit if a school wants to issue a credit. Now, a school has to write a standard, a mastery threshold, and they have to decide what evidence they'll consider against the mastery threshold. And they have to have a consistent way of assessing portfolio submissions to that threshold. But those credits, those mastery credits, are specific to the school, and they will never be standardized across schools. That's one of our, we have three central tenets that are immutable. It's written into our intellectual property. We will actually sue anybody who tries to use the word mastery credit and applies some things to it. It will never be letter graded or numbered. The credits themselves will never be standardized across schools. Each school gets to make their own credit. But the format of the mastery transcript itself will be standardized. So those are the three immutable truths of our effort. And because if you violate any one of the three, this isn't worth doing.
Right. Yeah. So I'm wondering, though, just to get back, because I know a lot of people are going to be asking about that content piece, right? And it's because we are so content driven, discipline driven, all that kind of stuff in schools. Will colleges and universities maybe, you know, still make that something that they want to see that will then drive schools to, you know, move more toward a content type of I don't know, explication or whatever, if we're not going to give it a grade or a number or whatever else? You know what I'm saying, right? I mean, how will higher ed react if there's nothing on the transcript that really speaks to?
Well, the problem is, the answer is higher ed is not a monolith, is the first answer, which is that if you talk to the college presidents, particularly the presidents of what I would call the private liberal arts colleges, I believe that they're going to be among our biggest fans as long as we do one thing really well. And they've been very clear. We've had some meetings with them. The biggest thing we have to do to make sure that they're our fans is to make sure that this is accessible to kids from all kinds of high schools, including kids who come from highly under-resourced schools. If we can make this a tool that can be used for kids who are in tough situations in terms of their high school, the college presidents, I believe, will be among our biggest fans. What they're asking for right now, and they're starting to realize, this is the reason I think this actually has a shot of working. Two things have changed in the last 10 years, and they're really pretty significant to this effort. The first is that colleges don't read admission files anymore on paper. They do it electronically. So if you're going to read a transcript electronically, why does it have to be static? Why can't your transcript be the homepage of your website, your database-driven website, with all that great, rich material attached to it? That's the first change. The second change is colleges have been asking for creative, analytical, risk-taking kids who can solve real-world problems and work in groups for years. What they've finally figured out, I believe, many of them, is that the system of selection that they're currently trapped in gets them exactly the opposite of what they're asking for.
Yeah.
It gets them the least risk-taking. This is among the least risk-taking group of kids in the history of prep schools. And it's not that they're not great kids. They're extraordinarily great kids. But they've been told that there's a game. There's one path to get all the rewards in life. And there's a game you play to get there. And that game is you take content-based courses, you work dutifully towards A's, and then the whole world is your oyster. Well, the problem is that most of the top 10 most selective colleges and universities in the country right now reject the majority of their valedictorian. So the kids are starting to realize, wait, this isn't fair. And the colleges are realizing, hey, you know what? These valedictorians, they're not very interesting kids. They're not risk-taking. They come in with record levels of mental health disorders, particularly anxiety and depression. Yeah. And do you wonder why? If you've been told, basically, that, hey, you're really talented, you should go to an Ivy League college. But, hey, to get there, don't get an A-.
Yeah. So,
you know, one quick thing, Bruce. When I talk to educators about this, I ask them, I say, raise your hand if you've seen a high school kid break into tears after receiving an A-. And every hand in the room goes up. And then I just look at him and go, is this okay? Are you okay with the system where the second best possible outcome results in a kid, a hardworking, wonderful, dutiful kid breaking into tears? I'm not.
God, I don't think anyone is underestimating the order and the magnitude of the task you're taking on. And I think, you know, this is front and center for so many schools at the moment. I did a paper, a post about 2 months ago called The Testing Emperor Finally Has No Clothes. I think it's had something like 300,000 you know, views or something crazy. And I've also got to say to you that our Facebook page is going mad at the moment with questions. We've got a lot of people on there with a lot of questions in a way that we haven't seen before. So all credit to you and your work. This is amazing. But I want to take a slight turn to the left or right. Take your pick. I better be careful when I say that. And talk about the non-college entrants. The kids who are going into apprenticeships or internships, and obviously, as you know only too well, this does differ fairly dramatically from country to country. And for instance, I could even be a little bit controversial and say, and in some countries, there's even some questions raised about whether, for instance, a child should finish 13 years of school, that their exit should be at the end of a year 12, for example. Have you got any sense about the way you're responding to that path, that post-secondary path that kids would take?
Sure. If you look at the kids who don't persist in school, right, the ones for whatever reason don't persist, there's a whole host of reasons. Some of them are life circumstance reasons that, that don't directly relate to school. But the ones within the control of school oftentimes have to do with kids coming to the conclusion that the system is rigged against them.
They
show up, they try, they get bad feedback, they just quit. And here's why. The biggest reason that kids, and many of these kids are intellectually facile enough to do just fine. The difference is oftentimes they come in with something that needs remediation. You know, they may have come from a household that has a little that's language impoverished, where there's just not a lot of books, there's not a lot of language. And so they come into school at 4 or 5 with some deficits, but they're intellectually completely capable of doing that. The problem is current system moves kids along as a cohort based on the timing of the teacher. So if you happen to be at the high end or the low end of that bell curve, if you're at the high end, you're sitting there watching your watch going, why do I have to sit here and wait for the rest of these guys? And if you're at the low end, you're starting to feel broken. And if I'm sorry, but if I'm year after year after year being judged and told I'm broken as a human being, I'm likely to quit. I'm like, well, what's the point of this? And so imagine if it's a system that allows kids to persist to mastery and allows them to have as much time as they need to persist to mastery. I would suspect that many of those kids will have a hockey stick, meaning they'll take a long time to get something, but once they do, they'll have it forever. There's actually great research that shows that there's an inverse relationship between how long it takes you to master something and your likelihood of retaining it.
Yep.
So kids who actually struggle to learn something, once they've actually mastered it, though, have a much greater capacity to learn it. But we never let those kids learn anything. We just keep moving them down. Okay, you didn't quite get first grade. Now we're going to start second grade. Well, you didn't quite get second grade. And what happens is those deficits start to become cumulative. And so right around third and fourth grade is when many kids start realizing that school is not going to work out for them. And if you let those same kids have more time, in our system, time is an irrelevant variable. You know, if in our system, let's say all three of us are trying to achieve our algebraic reasoning credit. Now, that's a content credit. And let's say, Bruce, math is something you've always loved and you're super prepared for. You might be ready to submit your evidence for your algebraic reasoning credit end of freshman year.
Yeah.
Will
yeah.
might be right behind you in early sophomore year. I might not be able to earn my algebraic reasoning credit until nearly my senior year.
Yeah.
But guess what? On our our transcript, there's no timestamp.
Yeah.
The colleges have no idea that it took me 4 years to earn it, and it took you guys a year and a half or a year to learn it. It doesn't matter. And so for kids who take a little longer, now, if you love math, Bruce, while I'm slogging away to get my basic algebraic reasoning, you might have earned five more quantitative reasoning credits. So it's not like MIT is not going to know the difference between you and me, but the time pressure. So, and here's, and this is, I think, the single biggest reason I think this will be a huge benefit to kids in under-resourced schools. You only get judged when you ask to be. You only get judged when you think your work is quality enough to judge. So that constant relationship between a teacher being your judge when you didn't ask to be judged goes away. So your teacher's only job is to help you build portfolio of good evidence until you're ready. And so with that time pressure gone, some kids who struggle won't feel like they're failing. They'll just be told, nope, keep going, try again, one more time, you're getting closer, that was better than last time, oh wow, you're finally getting closer. That's the feedback they'll be getting. So basically what we do is we don't get rid of summative judgment, but summative judgment is on demand by the student, not on demand by the teacher. And I think that may be, of all the things we're going to do, the single most important thing to encourage kids to persist in school and not to drop out.
Yeah, so I think that's right. I'm just going to quickly say, so into the post-secondary, have you had reaction from the business community, from the corporate sector, for kids who may complete their high school but may want to go into a workplace in position?
We haven't made that our purpose. Again, we're trying to make sure that the things we're most responsible for we get done first. But it's there is a lot of work on micro-credentialing and badges and certificates, and this makes a lot of sense. You can imagine how easily it would be for a kid to take their in-process mastery transcript and use it to apply for a job.
Yeah.
You send an employer a link, say, here's a link. You can click on, this is all the stuff I've learned in high school. And if you want to see, you know, that I'm really good at leading, click on my leadership badge, my leadership credit I just earned. And you can see the video testimonials from my from my teammates who talked about what a great leader I was.
Yeah, that was actually my sense. I thought it wasn't your focus, but I was also thinking it probably has even a bigger impact in that sector for all the reasons you just outlined. Yeah. Sorry, Will.
Yeah, no, it does, but it also puts a big premium on the way we build this. We have to build this so we can take a large variety of digital inputs. Mm-hmm. We also have to have a large variety of digital outputs, not just. Our transcript is easy to build as a self-contained unit, but it has to be able to be sent places, and pieces and parts of it have to be willing to be sent. So that's going to be a pretty complex task to figure out. So it's one of the reasons we needed to raise so much capital for the platform itself.
Yep.
A reasonably simple build as a core, but what really makes it complicated are the number of other pieces of software it will have to learn to talk to. That's the complicated part.
Yep.
And I think that answered actually a question from John Vandewall in the Facebook group about, you know, the software that you're going to use to track it. So you're in the process of building that.
And just a quick reminder that this episode of the Modern Learners podcast is being brought to you by Change School, where educational leaders get 8 weeks of intense immersion into the process of changing their schools and lifetime membership in a global community of change leaders seeking high bar, relevant, sustainable reimagining schools for the students they serve. Enrollment's now open for our fourth cohort, which starts in January, so head on over to change.school for all the details. And now, let's get back to our conversation.
One other question, too, from Steve Goldberg, who's an independent school educator down in North Carolina, I think. I wonder, and I think he's wondering, too, to what extent can kids kind of design their own credits? So, you know, he talks about his son who is a programmer. He's 10 years old, and basically he's really into C and Python. And, you know, he's wondering if basically is there a credit that he can develop and show mastery in that would then end up as part of the transcript, even though it may not be something that's consistent across, you know, the whole school. Mm-hmm.
The answer to that will be up to the sending school. The school is in charge of what credits are available for kids to earn. And it's highly likely that many schools will have unique individual credits that only one or two kids ever earn because those kids are so unusual in one area. One of the things colleges are interested in seeing is the relative degree of difficulty of a credit, right? And so in our model, there are two kinds of mastery credits. credits we're calling foundational credits. And foundational credits are graduation requirements. So every child at Hawken, there's a foundational credit in algebraic reasoning. That means every kid at Hawken has to earn the algebraic reasoning credit before they graduate. But then there are a different set of credits called advanced credits. And advanced credits are not required, and they're obviously, in almost all cases, more challenging to earn than foundational credits. And eventually, when we finally are up and running and have enough data, what will travel with advanced credits is number, which is called frequency of issuance. So if it has an 80 next to it, it means 80% of the kids at Hawken have earned this credit. If it has a 1, it means only 1% of all the graduates at Hawken School have ever earned this credit. So you'll be able to tell when a kid has earned a really, really rare credit. And that will be one of the ways to signal, you know, going back to our math analogy, Bruce might earn a mathematical reasoning credit that only 1 or 2% of the kids ever earn. That's a signal to MIT. Hey, this kid's a high-level quant. Looking for them, you might want to look at this kid. Whereas since I struggled just to get my algebraic reasoning, my rare credits might be in critical or creative thinking, or it might be in, you know, leadership and teamwork, or it might be in, you know, human relational skills. That may be where I distinguish myself. And that's the way we're going to provide a profile for colleges that will tell not only the unique shape of each child, but also what are their specialties? What are the things that they became extraordinary at? And the nice thing is once you add skills and habits of mind and socio-emotional learning to the suite of things, some kids who formerly looked pretty weak on just content acquisition might still look weak on content acquisition, but I might look extraordinary in terms of their socio-emotional skills. And and colleges are telling us they want kids who have extraordinary socio-emotional skills. And the only place they can see them now is embedded in their teacher recs, which isn't fair because some kids come from high schools, frankly, that don't have great teachers who aren't writing great recs. And so they suffer because their story isn't being told very well. Whereas in a crediting system like this, the high school is committing to honoring socio-emotional growth the same way it honors content acquisition.
So kind of to that point again about the uniqueness of the credit, another question comes from a teacher who, John Freer, who was my daughter's teacher during her brief stint in independent schools. But, you know, he wants to know, so let's say we take one of those credits that might be very different and an outlier, one percenter, right? Who sets the bar on mastery for school. Those credits? Is it the school, does? It's not a combination of kids who are informed? I mean, what if it is something that the school really doesn't know much about, but the kid wants to...
Sure. So here's the thing. Because this is a transcript, the school owns the transcript. And because these are credits, the school has to own the credit, the threshold. And we're using the term mastery threshold. You know, people will say, well, you can never really master anything. And that's 100% true. You know, if you say, have you mastered public speaking? That's farcical, right? You've never mastered it. So we're calling these thresholds, mastery thresholds. And so you can imagine that a foundational threshold in algebraic reasoning is probably what would used to be called an A in Algebra 2, right? So that's probably a mastery threshold for algebraic reasoning, give or take. Right. You might have a foundational credit in basic public speaking that is the basics, but you might have an advanced public speaking credit that is where the threshold is extraordinarily difficult to earn. And so the school has to write those, and those are institutional. And because they're institutional, they, I believe, should be, and schools can debate this, but I think they should be available to all kids. In other words, if it's a credit your school issues, it should be something that if more than one kid were to be able to achieve it, they can. So, if a student were to write a credit and talk the school into honoring, that would be fine. But then that credit would now be among the library of available credits for kids to strive for. Because you have to publish, as kids go into high school, you have to publish what are the range of things you should try to earn when you're in high school, and which of those are required, and which of those are beyond the minimum requirement. Just like we do now, you have to take these courses, but you don't have to take these courses.
So can I ask you a little bit about Hawken itself and the transformation that's taken place since you've been there, Scott? Sure. And think about that in the context, I guess, of leaders who are listening or watching this discussion, and what they can learn from what you went through in that process.
Sure, it's a long story, but I'll try to keep it.
You got 5 minutes.
The short answer is that you have to work with what you have. And what I found when I got here at Hawken were some really powerful raw ingredients that we just had to organize into an effort and a movement. Mm-hmm. One was that we were founded by a literal disciple of John Dewey. Yeah. Our original founding documents were very progressive. Now, over time, like a lot of schools, we became an AP prep school factory that overprivileged content. I also found a really talented faculty who were really committed to the kids at the school. But what I also found was that there was a wide variety of interpretations around where we're going, and a wide variety of interpretations. So we spent almost 2 years just defining what we meant by our mission. And we rewrote mm-hmm. our mission. We wrote a document called our 3 P's, our purpose, promise, and principles.
Yep.
And we got really granular. You know, principle 9, we believe that to make meaning from knowledge, students need to use Cleveland, nature, and the global communities as extensions of our classroom. And then once we wrote it, we intentionally wrote it to be aspirational. We knew when we launched the 3 P's, we were going to immediately have people say, well, wait, you're not doing that. And we said, yes, we know. This is where we're going, not where we are. And so then we did a big gap analysis. What's the gap between what we just put out there as what we want to be and what we are? And let's talk about how we work together as a team to get there. And let's see if we can find some early, what I would call levers for change. Are there some things we can do structurally that will give us a real advantage to move this? And we did 2 big ones, particularly in the upper school, which is the division that needed probably the most energy to the system. One, we completely blew up the schedule and rebuilt it. And we now have some periods of time where kids take one class all day, every day for 3.5 weeks, very much like Colorado College. And they get a full semester academic credit for it. They do that twice a year. Mm-hmm. The second thing is we bought an extension campus in University Circle, an old mansion that we gutted and renovated. And it's in the city. It's in the core of we're a suburban day school. It's in the core of the city. And now we take our second graders, our fourth graders, our seventh graders, our ninth graders there for 2 days, 4 days, a week, sometimes 3 weeks, and we relocate school down there. And so we give them this, and it's in this neighborhood where all of the opportunities are within walking distance. So they can walk to the south are all these incredible civic organizations, you know, museums, hospitals. And to the north is the second poorest neighborhood in the Midwest, a neighborhood that needs some good neighbors. And so we use that location as a lever to move our curriculum. So find levers would be, first thing I would do is find your resources. What do you know you have now?
Yep.
Organize around a central, I told the board when they hired me, I said, if I only accomplished 2 things in my entire tenure, you're going to be really happy with everything. The first is get everybody on the same page. And the second is hire talent. If you do those 2 things really, really well, the rest kind of works itself out. If you skip either one of those steps, you're in big trouble, right? You can have a great mission, but you don't have the right talent to execute it. You're in trouble. Or you can have great talent, but they're all pulling in different directions. You're not going to be able to do this. So for example, right now, when I speak at most admission open houses, and first thing I do is I hand out the 3 P's to every family. And I ask them, I said, I want you to read this document. And if there's 2 parents here, once you read it separately, do not compare notes. And at the end, I want you to take your emotional temperature, not intellectualize this. How do you feel? And if you feel great and you want the whole thing, you're in the right room. If you want to wordsmith this, you need to go to another school. This isn't going to work out for you. This is a prefix menu. We're going to do all of these things to your children, not some of these things. So if you don't like them all, this is the wrong journey. And so we've very intentionally given up a chunk of our market. The more traditional families in Cleveland don't come to Hawken anymore, and the more forward-looking progressive families do. But we're outperforming any sort of previous enrollment effort we've had. We have record enrollment for the 8th consecutive year. So, and we did it by giving up part of the market. We gave up. Don't be afraid to be so specific to a core set of beliefs that you actually repel certain families. I think the prep schools that get themselves into trouble are the ones who try to be all things to all people. And then they're nothing to everybody. And that's a real problem.
I think is the third piece that you're probably being overlooking. And inspirational leadership, I think, has a fair bit to do with where you've taken Hawken, Scott, to be fair. And I think your ability to sell a very complex message with a huge amount of clarity, as you've just done through this discussion, I think it plays a big part in this because, you know, you're distilling it down to very core ideas, which I think in education and particularly around the change process, people get lost. They either want to get lost and they're happy to get lost because that doesn't mean they have to change anything, or, you know, they just can't see the wood for the trees. And for instance, I was intrigued. Your example there about levers was rather interesting, because you probably know John Silly Brown and Hagel have just done some work around the edges. And you were talking about it as levers. And I was thinking, hey, there's the edges, because people are always a little bit confused about what's fundamental and what's incremental. And incrementalism sometimes doesn't take us path to where you want to go. But you gave excellent examples there. And I think, you know, that change process is something that so many people have trouble with. But the direction you're taking it, I think, is so significant that so many people will learn from it.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. One of the beauties of levers is that, you know, there's two ways to mobilize people, hope or fear. And fear is just not a lot of fun. So the beautiful thing about levers is if you create hopeful levers, they're kind of attractive nuisance that start wooing your kind of most innovative faculty, like, oh, what's that? Oh, we have a new campus in University Circle. Well, can I use it? Absolutely. And then, you know, it starts slow and people get frustrated at first, but if you just keep with it, those levers, those hopeful levers just become irresistible to a certain sector of your faculty, and they start building great things. And then when they get rewarded for building in the direction of the mission, that group in the middle of the bell curve joins right in, and then you've won, and then you've got something, and then it's self-sustaining. Right now, I don't have to generate a lot of innovation much anymore at Hawken. It's sort of self-generating at this point, and it wasn't at first, but it is now.
But just to finish on that, you're also, though, you're also, as you said, not trying to be everything to everyone, either for faculty or for parents. You made that clear about the parents. And in your paper, you made it very clear about the notion of talent and tenure and the history we have in tenure and the influence that has on the faculty we have. And that may not, that is not, I don't think, you know, offers the best results for kids. But you're prepared to take that on.
That's really where I thought maybe we could finish up is with that magazine PDF that you put out a few years ago that was titled Why Hawken Must Lead. And it was the one piece that I read that first introduced me to your thinking and your work. And I was kind of blown away by the beginning of it. We talked about this before we came on, but you know, that one line that education in America is fundamentally broken. And I mean, there's not a lot of nuance in that. And I'm curious as to the ways in which that piece and maybe some other things that you did built the capacity of your school community to really understand the urgency or really understand the kind of foundations for the change conversations that you were going to have and the things that you were thinking of moving toward. I mean, can you just talk a little bit about, you know, how to go about that and how important that is in order for people to engage in that conversation around change at a really high level?
Well, what that piece was is a kind of echolocation. I'm a big believer when you're getting ready to change that foreshadowing and echolocation are really important strategies.
Can you describe that term? I mean, just...
Sure, sure. You know, bats and dolphins find the edges of things and find out where they're going by sound. They send sound out, and when it comes back to them, they know where to go. And so that piece wasn't actually designed to be sent out to the world. It was really just an internal piece in the Hawken magazine, because as we were getting ready to do kind of more radical, innovative educational change, I wanted to get a sense of, okay, how much appetite is there in our parent body? How much appetite is there in our alumni body? How freaked out are we getting ready to make people? I'd like to kind of know before we do this rather than after we do this. So I very intentionally
That was a good way to get it. And so
I told the board, I said, you know, I'm going to let it all hang out and let them know how I really feel about the model that we're going to do. And I want to see what comes back. And it was really shocking because we got a lot of support, but the places where I got the greatest support were the places I least expected it. And the places where I expected the most support is the places I got the least. The old guard alumni, the people who are in their 70s and 80s, were the biggest fans of that piece.
Isn't that interesting?
They're the ones who've lived a whole life and go, yeah, that model is broken. It doesn't work anymore. The current students were the least receptive.
Because
they're like, hey, wait a second. I'm geared up my whole life to win this game. And now you're going to change all the rules on me?
Yeah.
So they were like, hey, wait a second. So, but it was really useful because it triggered the dialogue that I wanted triggered, which was, are we happy with our current model? It's not about Hawken. It's about the model that Hawken and most other schools are wrapped around. Is that the flagpole we should be wrapping everything around, or should we look for a new pole? And the answer from the community, because I did a series of workshops, community workshops right after that was launched, was about 80 to 90%. Yeah, let's go find a new flagpole. And I said, well, okay, but remember, we have to carefully unwrap ourselves off the old one. We can't just abandon it because we have an awful lot of infrastructure wrapped around that model. And so that was really what it was designed to do, is start that conversation and just to see how ready was the Hawking community for some of the stuff we were getting ready to do. And when the answer was pretty ready, then we accelerated things.
Definitely put a link at the bottom of this post when it goes up on the blog for the podcast to that piece, because I still think it's a really relevant and inspirational piece that, you know, it just captures a lot of the urgency, I think, for at least the conversation, like you said. And I love that term, echolocation. I think that that's a great way of kind of putting it. Listen, Scott, can't tell you how much we appreciate the time today, and really, really big fans of your work. Looking forward to seeing what happens with the whole mastery transcript piece. And, you know, when I talk about that, people really take pause when they hear yep. the extent to which you are trying to move that piece of the rock, at least. And I think that that's a huge, you know, you talk about levers. I think that's a huge one. I mean, if that can be moved, then I think a whole bunch of other things get a heck of a lot easier to change. And so I'm really looking forward to it. I know Bruce is too, and anything our community can do to help you in that effort, just let us know.
Absolutely.
But sincerely, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And sincere best wishes for a great holiday.
Well, thank you both for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And it's a mutual admiration society for sure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Thanks very much.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the Modern Learners Podcast. If you're someone who's in a position of educational leadership or who someday aspires to be, and you enjoy diving deep into learning and innovation, we invite you to join us in Modern Learners' newest community, Change Leaders. I'm Lynn Hill, the community manager of CLC, and our space can help ensure you're using your professional learning time to the fullest. CLC offers carefully curated content to help you find signal among the noise. Thought-provoking questions and discussions with inspiring community members who are serious about change, live events and access to the Modern Learners team, and a circle of critical friends who will help you kick off change efforts in your schools. Visit changeleaders.community to check out a free 30-day trial and join in our movement. And I look forward to learning with you.